Darkness surrounds you as you drag your creation out of the woods. The clanging sounds of your spear hitting the brush above you break the silence. And as you listen closer, sounds of exertion emerge from all around. Your journey backwards comes to a stop when you feel the coolness of the sea. And now your lungs fill with the smell of salt, and your mind with a sensation of peace at the calm lapping of the waves. This is the first salty water you've ever encountered in your life, and tales of the sea told by your comrades have surely frightened you, though now the black, flat horizon feels oddly welcoming. You are no stranger to water, after all. Your Slavic honor would demand that. You close your eyes and try to imagine the sea as easy to manage as the slow river back home. Your out-of-body experience, however, is soon interrupted by the whispers of your crewmates. The fire is lit. It's time to push out. You open your eyes to see the light of the bonfire, your signal to cross this body of water. The firelight is soon joined by another, that of the first rays of morning, sheathing the bay in a blanket of gold. On the other side of the calm waters lay something unimaginable. A mountain of stone reaching to the sky, marble walls glowing amber in the sun, houses replacing the trees of the forest, and yet no less numerous. You have a hard time believing people could live in such a place, and yet the desire to get closer to it is intoxicating. And here you are, approaching this magnificence in a simple canoe. This thought, though, is pushed out of your mind. You have a glorious job to do. You and your two comrades begin to row in unison, gaining speed as the walls of the city lean ever closer. You take a momentary break to ready your quiver of arrows, given to you only yesterday by the horse lords who have been leading the assault by land. This thought then leads into the next, your heart beating ever faster now. Where would be the best to disembark? Do they know we're coming? Yet again, however, these thoughts are interrupted by another sight. This one, more sinister. You see sails approaching from the towers of the city. Boats with hulls higher above the water than you are tall. Listening closer, you can make out the heaves of a whole team of slaves below deck, grunting in unison to propel their boat towards your tiny canoe at a speed you simply cannot match. Make ready, they're onto us. Row to their side. Your team turns the canoe away from the city, hoping now only to dodge their incoming attack. You glance back. They're close. You see the eyes of the men on deck. In a desperate effort, you stop paddling and are able to send off one arrow towards the bearded man pointing in your direction. With this, a thunderous impact, a deafening splinter, your canoe is shattered into multiple pieces. The water surrounds you, and the boats, like the horsemen who brought you here, retreat into the misty horizon. To Between the Seas. This is episode 8, The Avars and Their Time. The experience of a brave Slavic marine imagined prior took place during the Avar siege of Constantinople, the city, in 626. Though the Byzantines had fallen far and were currently in the midst of their greatest crisis, this siege would fail, with the consequences helping to define Carpathia for the next two centuries. The premier inter-European state in this region during the First Dark Age were the Avars of Pannonia, a steppe confederation which had terrorized all those around them for a half century prior to their siege. Although not well known today, their organization would last for 250 years during the transformative times following the migration period, a staggering amount of time compared to the typical rhythm of foreign tribal challengers. They would leave a permanent legacy on Inner Europe's identity and institutions, although in a uniquely indirect way. So today, we will dive into their story, focusing specifically on the long period after their failure at Constantinople, during which they would miraculously cling to power. We will also indulge the stories of the cultures around them, who would alternate in and out of independence for the duration of the long 8th century. To start, we should remind ourselves of Avar origins, and how they rose into being the terror of Inner Europe and Byzantium. They would first appear in the records on the north coast of the Black Sea in the 6th century, having come down the steppe treadmill from the east. They were presumably fleeing the rise of the great Turkic Khaganate, which would reach its height at a similar point, unifying almost the entire Eurasian steppe. The Turks referred to the Avars as escaped slaves to the Byzantine diplomats of the time, and showed a great enmity towards them, explaining their lightning-fast migration across the steppe and into Europe. However, like the classic steppe treadmill pattern, weak runaway nomads in the east still translate to awe-inspiring conquerors in the west at this time. The Byzantines recognized their potential, and so would invite the Avars into Carpathia in order to silence the squabbling Germanic tribes of the Gepids and Lombards to the north, who were interrupting their campaigns of reconquest in Italy. The Avars would oblige, but quickly turn on their Roman masters, demanding increasingly high tribute and concessions of defenses while they were occupied. As we went over previously, the Byzantines would succumb to their overextension and internal crises in the Balkans, and in the 7th century would remain almost fully open to joint Avar-Slavic raiding and all of their holdings west of Constantinople. Their forces would prove to be powerful, and their band of horse lords would come to hold sway over a vast region, encompassing the entirety of Carpathia, portions of the Riverlands and Plateau, and a large part of the Pontic Steppe as well. So what made their military so explosively effective? Well, the explosiveness can be attributed to the weakness of the Byzantines, who were the main stabilizing power in the region. When the threat appeared, they could neither annihilate them by themselves nor mobilize enough resources to build a strong coalition of inner European tribes around them. The Avars, meanwhile, were hardened and experienced, presumably after years of taking part in the violent conflicts raging in the Far East with the rise of the Turkic Khaganate. They had also brought something with them out of the chaos of China, the stirrup. Though prototypes had been made before, the Avars would bring into Europe a revolutionary model which provided enough support to adequately brace and control the horse, while also spreading the force so as to not exhaust or hurt the animal. With this invention of the stirrup, the Avars could not only handle their horses far more effectively, they could also multiply the power of their weapons, through bracing with their lances or assuming a better posture with their other weapons or with their bows. Though horses had been extremely useful before in warfare, the stirrup would make them dominant anywhere which could support them. This innovation would spread only gradually throughout Europe, however, which gave the Avars an immense early advantage. Against such a force, any opposing army of the Avars would have to rely either on extremely skilled tacticians or the walls of their cities, which was a much safer bet. Here again, though, the Avars would bring tricks up their sleeve. Unlike most steppe warriors, the Avars would become skilled in siege warfare. They would utilize both knowledge gained in the wars of the East and China, and knowledge from the local Romanized populations which had been overtaken as the Byzantines retreated to their walls. They would then combine this with the formidable foot power of the Slavic tribes which they had subjugated during their invasions. The results would be disaster in Carpathia for the first 30 years of the 600s, as Avars and Slavs sacked city after city, from Sirmium on the Danube to Salona on the Adriatic. Catching up to our current story now, two cities would halt the meteoric rise of the Avars, those being Thessalonica, whose siege was abandoned in 618, and, crucially, Constantinople itself in 626. The siege of Constantinople would fail due to the impregnability of its walls, which would become famous for their inability to compromise, and the failure of the Avars and Slavs to take the seas around the city, thus allowing itself to resupply from across the straits and abroad. The Avars would attack the city in a joint venture with the Sassanid Persians, though the Persian effort would be quickly undone by the defenders, with many leaders captured, further contributing to the siege's failure. The Avars had brought almost 80,000 warriors to capture the city, and their inability to do so would send an earthquake throughout their vast realm. See, the Avars were organized with a political formula that fully relied upon their prestige, as this is what convinced the tribal warriors who made up their elite to follow the Union. With enough evidence and momentum of victory in battle, their confederation was strong and would only tend to expand. Those subjugated peoples which made up the majority of the strength would be convinced that throwing their lot in with the Avars was their best option for long-term survival. To lose such a decisive and major battle against an enemy who had appeared to be on their last legs, though, that would have the risk of unraveling the whole political formula. In the late 620s and early 630s, the vast Avar Confederacy would fall into civil war and dissolution, just as the Huns had before at the death of Attila. Crucially, they would lose control of the large portion of the western steppe which they controlled, as several tribes making up the confederation rebelled. The most notable of these rebelling tribes were the Bulgars, who we will get to soon. As the Avars were a nomadic people of the steppe at their base, the loss of this land would force those elites who stayed loyal to leave their home, and the environment which suited them and their horses the best. This further contributed to the loss of prestige, which only continued the cycle of breakdown. To the west, the vanguards of the Slavic migrations who had made it into the Alps and the plateau held a proud tradition of independence, and with the weakening of the Avar forces, the leadership of the various tribes would look to unite in revolt. This revolt would prove to be remarkably successful, and lead to a period of early Slavic preeminence over the large borderlands which connect the plateau, Carpathia, and the Riverlands. Many of these fractured tribes would choose to elevate a Frankish merchant named Samo as their king, thus unifying their effort to cast off the Avars. Samo is a very interesting character, firstly because his position as a lowborn merchant, and secondly because of his identity as a Western Frank. The Slavs were traditionally oriented towards the east, having emerged from the swamps of the eastern riverlands. The Avars would subjugate the peoples of the two primary Slavic confederations, the Sclaveni and the Antes, during their initial push over the Carpathians in the mid-6th century. From here on, the Slavic tribes and the Avars would be in a close partnership, and most reference to the Slavs from the Latin or Byzantine sources of the time is only in partnership with the Avars, who were seen as the larger threat. As mentioned in prior episodes, this partnership was forced and tenuous at best. The Slavs much preferred to live in their own societies, and given the opportunity, this is the state the tribes would build for themselves. Still though, whether under Avar dominion, or living on their own in terrain too rough or isolated for the horse lords, outside influence would be a rare thought, especially given the small size of their settlements. Samo breaks this illusion, however, and can explain a lot about the Slavic-Germanic frontier. His very existence proves the economic connections of the Franks to the Avar Confederacy, with the fact that these tribes would elevate him voluntarily to be their king, taking this relationship even further. implying a more profound influence of the Germanic confederations in the area. The resulting picture we get is one of a true borderland. On one side of the plateau, the Franks would be building their civilizational fusion of Germanic tradition and Latin Christianity, while on the other, the Avars would be clinging to power in Carpathia, extracting all the wealth they can from the crumbling Byzantines. The Avars and Franks themselves would skirmish several times, with the Avars more often than not launching raids onto the plateau if they were not otherwise occupied with the Byzantines. In the middle of these feuding powers were several independent cultures, who could sway closer to one camp or the other depending on the political circumstances. This would have had to have been a very deliberate balancing act for these Slavic tribes, as we will see with Samo's kingdom. According to Fredegar, an unknown author who sources most of the information about Samo's kingdom, the Avars were known to torment the Slavs, often subjugating and conscripting their men, seizing their women, and taking their produce and goods that they've developed. After a generation of this, the Slavs would become very unruly, regularly launching revolts. The Carantanians, the furthest Slavic settlers who had made it all the way to the Eastern Alps and the passes to Italy, had broken free of Avar control early on, likely due to their isolation and rough terrain. Other tribes, however, would have to continue their resistance. This job was doubtless made easier by the Frankish supplies. From the Frankish point of view, they would be weakening one of their rivals and indulging in a lucrative trade for slaves from the east. With the Avar failure of 626, the Slavs would seek their chance, launching a revolt in those very years. It's likely that these fiercely independent tribes chose to elect Samo so as to guarantee no one tribe would have preeminence in their confederation. An outsider Frank could ease these tensions and allow them to focus on defeating their real enemy, the Avars. Tribes from Bohemia, Moravia, Slovakia, the Riverlands, and Pannonia would join the revolt, with the Carantanians either joining Samo or offering him assistance. Against this bloc, the weakened Avars would be defeated, leading to a period of independence for this confederation of tribes. The independence would be immediately challenged, however, by the other power that the kingdom was jammed between, the Franks. Seeing the breakaway from the Avar sphere, the Frankish king of Austrasia, Dagobert, would claim these territories as being under his realm's protection, and launch an invasion in 630 to enforce this. The invasion would take place in three branches, led by Dagobert himself. Samo would mount a defense, leading his tribes in battle against the main Austrasian army at Vogastaburg. The Slavs would go on to smash the Franks decisively in this battle, shattering their invasion and putting them on the defensive. Seeing this, several Slav tribes subjugated by the Franks would take their own opportunity for independence, including the powerful tribe of the Sorbs, a group of Polabian Slavs who owned a large land north of Bohemia and the western Riverlands. The Sorbs, led by the leader Dervan, would join Samo's union and indulge alongside them in crippling raids on the Germanic frontier. They would sack settlements in Thuringia and the Austrasian frontier in several raids following the Frankish defeat. Eventually, a Frankish duke sent to stop the raids would instead ally with Samo against Austrasia around 640, putting his kingdom for a time as the preeminent power of the region, fully turning the tables on both the Franks and the Avars. Samo's kingdom would last for the duration of the life of Samo himself, and he would maintain cohesion through forming bonds with each individual tribe in the confederation. The Lord of the Road, as he was called, was said to have had at least 12 wives, all from leading Slavic families in the kingdom, and out of these unions, 22 sons and 15 daughters. However strong these bonds were during his life, however, the kingdom would collapse when Samo died in 658. Unlike the Germanic traditions of male children inheriting the highest title, the Slav seemed to prefer to appoint leaders based on popular perception of merit. We can only assume the tribes could not agree on a single leader after Samo, And with this sudden power vacuum, the Avars would be the ones to sweep back into power over the tribes of Bohemia, Moravia, and Slovakia. Further south, however, the story following the collapse of Sama's kingdom would unfold differently. In the lands of modern Austria and Slovenia, the Carantanians would manage to hold on to their independence. It is unknown to what extent the Carantanians were integrated with Sama previously, but it is known that their leader offered assistance to the revolt. Even as the Avars swooped back onto the plateau, Carantania would maintain itself, united into a strong realm under a man named Valuk. With their strategic position connecting Carpathia to southern Germany and Italy, the Carantanians would go on to be a major regional power for the next century. They would consistently fend off raids from the Avars, fight back and forth battles with the tribe of the Bavari for control of the Alps, and intervene in the affairs of the Italian Duchy of Friuli. Demographically and culturally, they would have a profound impact on the wider region. Their traditions would develop according to their unique position of connecting the Western Slavic expansions to those of the Slovenian Antes to the south, bridging the gap created by the nomadic Avars and later Magyar. They would also bridge the gap between Carpathia, the plateau, and the Mediterranean, as they offered some of the friendlier passes through the Alps, which divided these three regions from each other. The result of this unique position would be a unique culture, influenced by the Germanic and Italian Alpine subcultures around them, yet still remaining Slavic at its core. They would become known for their peasant-based system of legitimacy, carrying over the traditional political practice of allowing countrymen to choose leaders based on their perceived merit to the community. Individuals chosen would thus be imbued with legitimacy for the rest of their lives, in exchange for trust that they may see to the prosperity of its agrarian inhabitants. Although comparisons to a modern electoral system have been made of this practice, I think it's better to understand this as a form of community-based aristocracy, where rather than political leaders acting as representatives of their constituents, they would act as its best and chosen elites, so long as they recognized their obligation to the community which sprang them. Its people would spread over a large chunk of the Eastern Alps, and demographically lead to the modern Slovenian culture, which speaks a different language than the more related Serbo-Croat dialects further down the Dinarics. They would also heavily affect the future Germanic culture of Austria, especially in the regions of Styria and Carinthia, named after the Carantanians. Speaking of the Germans, though, they would eventually advance in the battle of influence which had ensnared the Carantanians. In the mid-8th century, the Avars would reorganize and begin to seriously threaten the Carantanian independence, at which point the Slavs would request Bavarian protection. The Bavarians would accept this request, provided the Carantanians convert to Christianity, which they did with the assistance of the Latins. This action would throw the Carantanian lot in with the Franks for the foreseeable future. But back to the Avar crisis in the 7th century. At the same time as Sama's revolts, the Avars would face additional fragmentation on all fronts, with the arrival of the Croats representing a major Avar defeat. The Avars and their Slavic allies had devastated what is modern Croatia early on in their arrival, and by the early 7th century had consumed the whole coast all the way to Dalmatia, with the local hub of Salona following in 611. Archaeological sites show significant settlement of proper Avar tribes in the area, unlike most territories on that side of the Danube, although Slavic settlement would have surely been common as well. Meanwhile, north of the Carpathians, stretching almost the entire duration of the southern riverlands, there is evidence of a culture known as White Croatia. This culture will persist for some time, and we will return to be examining their society another episode. But for our story today, we only need to know of their existence. At some point, likely during the revolt of Samo, a breakaway faction of Croats migrated south and attacked the Avars in this region of Carpathia. The weakened Avars were defeated in a major victory for the Croats, and their tribe proceeded to establish independent political groupings in the area. It is thought that this land was already inhabited in majority by tribes of the prior Slavini culture, and that the Croats, through defeating the Avars who controlled this region more directly than others, would replace them as their warrior aristocracy. In doing so, the Croats would be one of the first true examples of Slavic horsemen states, wherein groups of disorganized Slavic tribes would be conquered and assimilated into a new identity through the sudden arrival of a well-organized mounted warrior elite. Two further notes give this arrival some more interesting context. First, the Byzantines, through a foreign policy manual written in the 10th century, claimed that the Croats migrated to that region only at Byzantine request during the time of Heraclius in the early 7th century, and lived thereon as Christianized Byzantine subjects. It is indeed likely that the Byzantines may have sent envoys to the White Croats inviting assistance against the Avars, who had only recently threatened their capital. This was actually quite a common Byzantine diplomatic practice, and one of their most effective methods of managing their neighbors throughout their long history. The second part of this, though, that the Croats remained Byzantine subjects and were Christianized, is likely an exaggeration. It's possible the Croats may have been included in the Byzantine title system, but as mentioned in prior episodes, there's very little the Byzantines could have done at this point to influence a group in the Balkan interior. The further weakening of the Avars would have been the prize in and of itself. The second interesting note here is the likely Iranian origins of the Croatian tribe. Etymologically, the Croats do not seem to have a Slavic name, as it had been matched to Iranian place names in the steppe. This would align with our narrative of Slavic ethnogenesis, with many political groupings arriving out of the Iranian tribes who had wandered too far into the riverlands and been assimilated into the majority Slavic culture. For the Croats in particular, there is later evidence, as described by an Arab traveler, of tribes consuming mare's milk, a common practice among the tribes of the steppe, which gives this idea of Iranian origin further legitimacy. For the next century or so, the Croats would settle into their new homelands, assimilating the Slavini tribes there into a common Croatian culture, until the arrival of the Franks in the later 8th century. The chaotic 7th century, however, would also see the arrival of another fundamental Carpathian identity, yet further down the Sava, that being the Serbs. Serbian origins actually have fragments of references prior to this time, with a similar Iranian connection possessing some strong evidence. There are Greek records of an Iranian Serboid tribe living east of the Black Sea during times of antiquity, with the later Sarbi tribe recorded by Arabs in that region. This implies a similar Iranian etymology for the later tribe of the Serbs, which may be an evolution of that same grouping. Already in our own story, the tribe of the Sorbs was noted as having participated in Sama's revolt. The story of the Carpathian Serbs begins with them. The ruler Dervan of the Sorbs, known for his raids of Austrasia during the time of Samo, is thought to have had two sons. Serbian legend, recorded through the Byzantines, states that the two brothers would divide the tribe of White Serbia in the north of the Avars sometime in the mid-7th century. One brother would stay in the riverlands, continuing the Sorb legacy, while the other would take half of the population into Carpathia. Unlike the Croats, it looks like the Avars may have been too busy with other revolts to deal with these new arrivals, and the Serbs were largely able to assume control of their lands with little conflict. The Byzantine records state here as well that the Serbians arrived only at Byzantine request and settled into being Christian Byzantine subjects. They originally were granted land near Thessalonica, but would later choose to migrate north, settling modern southern Serbia upon seeing the land. It is likely that this story too embellishes Byzantine involvement, though it is true that the Serbs would face far more Byzantine influence than the Croats further northwest, and may have been among the earlier adopters of Christianity in the Slavic Balkans. Widespread Christianization likely still did not take place for the Serbs, though, until the late 8th or 9th centuries. Here, too, Serbian culture developed from a Serbian mounted warrior aristocracy, imposing control over the fractured Slavonian tribes who had inhabited the land prior. This aristocracy would be successful over the long term, thus creating the Serbian culture, though politically they would remain fragmented. The similar Sloveni origins for both the Serbs and Croats would give rise to the Serbo-Croat language, though their cultures will be differently influenced by their later church allegiances. Moving further east along the Danube, we come to yet another Avar breakaway state. This one, though, would have a very active 7th and 8th centuries, truly menacing the powers around them. These, of course, are the Bulgars. As I mentioned earlier, the Bulgars have Turkic origins, and may consist of a minority of Hunnic remnants along with migrants from the great Turkic Khaganate of the eastern and central steppe. Though the Avars would hold sway over most of the European steppe, this would change with the crisis of the early 7th century, at which point the Bulgars would break away to form their own confederation, known as Old Great Bulgaria. It would appear the Bulgars were quite a large faction within the Avars, as this revolt not only further crippled Avar power, but also resulted in a separate civil war in the 630s, during which Bulgar rebels in Pannonia were defeated and sent to Bavaria, where they were treacherously massacred at a feast. Anyways, the man who had united the Bulgars east of the Carpathians, Kovrat, would die around 642, leaving his confederation in the hands of his five sons. Around this time, the Bulgars would learn the dangers of this treadmill and face defeat at the hands of the Turkic Khazars, migrating west. Each brother would then scatter along with a portion of the confederation. Two of these brothers are important for our story. One we will call Kuvur, and one named Asparuk. Kuvur migrated west back into the Avar Confederacy, where he was given lands to rule in the south. However, tensions would soon flare up, forcing this group to battle the Avars for their independence, a fight that they would win. Kuvur would then distance his Bulgars from the Avars, settling somewhere around modern Macedonia. The second and more politically significant group would be those Bulgars led by Asparuk. They would be championed by the Byzantines as a counter to the Avars, and end up settling near the north bank of the Danube Delta. However, Asparuk would soon lead his 10,000 horsemen over the river in the 670s, an action which the Byzantines would see as being too dangerous, and they would lead an army north to meet them. This army, though, would be smashed by the people of the steppe, and given the situation of the Byzantine Empire in the 7th century, they would be forced to sign a humiliating peace acknowledging a Bulgar confederation between the Balkan Mountains and the Danube River in modern Bulgaria. Although Byzantium had already lost most of the Balkans, this would be the first official treaty which recognized a separate state there. The Bulgars would continue to be heavily aimed towards the Mediterranean south in their history, largely leaving inner Europe alone for now. They would be a consistent wildcard for the Byzantines, however, and present a constant threat to the north. In 689, Kuvur's Macedonian Bulgars would ambush and almost annihilate an army led by the emperor himself, who was returning from campaign in Greece, thus preventing the Byzantines from reclaiming land which had been lost to the Slavs, and indirectly helping with the long-term cultural shifts in Carpathia. Following this, these Bulgars would disappear from the record, likely being Slavicized into the local tribes. Asparuk's Bulgars, however, would do anything but disappear from the record, first deciding to help Justinian II reclaim the Byzantine throne from exile in 705, and then dramatically riding to the aid of Byzantium during the Arab siege of Constantinople in 717, only a year after the Bulgars had ended a war against them. This later event would prove extremely important in stopping the spread of Islam into Europe, an event which had seemed almost probable at the time. The main event for the Bulgars would come later in the 8th century, however. The line of Asparuk would die out in 739, bringing widespread instability. The instability would bring to the forefront inner Bulgar tensions over how their confederation should interact with the Slavs which they had subjugated on the plain. So far, the Bulgars had maintained their own tightly knit cultural identity, remaining together on the steppe-like terrain near the Black Sea. They had a walled capital, Lika, which rather than being a city was more of a massive steppe meeting ground, and served as both a physical location separating the Bulgars from the Slavs around them, but also as a place to preserve their steppe culture. The Slavs, meanwhile, were subjugated and likely abused, though otherwise allowed to maintain their culture and even tribal leaders. The problem for the Bulgars, however, was that their economy relied on the produce of the green-thumbed Slavs, who as always would provide the overwhelming bulk of pastoral and agrarian products for their steppe overlords. The two groups stayed together due to the force of the steppe warriors, the stability they provided, and the ability of the Bulgars to bring in wealth through trading. As a centralized force, they were able to negotiate and regulate tolls for merchants quite well, which worked symbiotically with the old Greek trading towns of the region, as well as with the ever-productive Slavs of the interior. They remained fragile, however. Unless they integrated with the bulk of their population, all it would take was a moment of weakness and disunity for their entire state to dissolve, just as so many had before them. And so, a civil war would erupt, with one side hoping to maintain the old Hunnic ways of glorifying the steppe life and pursuing war with Byzantium, while the other looked to focus on state building and gradual integration with the Slavs, ideally with the peaceful Byzantium to their south. The Byzantines, however, would not sit idly by to let the Bulgars figure this out for themselves. They would launch several attacks into Bulgaria, defeating them time and time again in their weakened state. The elusive Bulgars would find a way to survive this somehow, though, and this would cause Byzantium to double down, fully devastating the land and using every trick of intrigue that they had. A chaotic back and forth would ensue, as one after another Bulgar claimant would shoot their shot just to be unseated or hunted by the Byzantines. Eventually, the Bulgars would gain the upper hand, after decades of attrition on either side. In 774, the Khan would trick the Emperor Constantine V into revealing all spies working within the Confederation. These spies would then be summarily executed. Order would be restored over the next 20 years after defeating further Byzantine incursions, leaving the Bulgars to rebuild their devastated lands. After all of that, the Bulgarians would seemingly choose a compromise option, maintaining the centralization of the previous clique, while also pursuing gradual integration with the Slavic tribes politically and socially. As an upshot to these decades of conflict, the Slavic tribes were thought to have been brought in to a pseudo-Bulgarian identity through the strong emotions of opposition to the devastation wrought by the marauding Byzantines over the last few generations. They saw the Bulgars as comrades in fighting this future. Another lucky break for the Bulgars would come in the 790s, as their original enemies to the north, the Avars, would finally begin to collapse, opening the door to immense opportunity. And it is with these Avars once more that we will end our episode. Backing up the years of separatism in the 7th century, the Avars would manage to hold on to power only through consolidation. Avar elites would contract from their massively overextended confederation into the relatively defensible plains of Pannonia. In doing so, they would leave their desolate, subjugated populations to fend for themselves, while they brought back the full wealth of their century of raiding the Mediterranean world. Although written records from this period are scarce due to the Avars possessing no writing system, archaeological finds are remarkably common, with tens of thousands of examples. Those finds from this period show an extreme amount of wealth, largely taken from Mediterranean styles, though with some homegrown aspects as well. Ornate patterns of gold and silver would adorn intricately designed lamellar armor, with graves being showered with Byzantine coins. Like the Bulgars, the strength of the Avars, and the reason they were able to survive this chaos, was the closeness of their leading class. For the duration of their 250-year reign, the Avars would hold on to their separate steppe faction, maintaining their skill in horseback and their network of subjugated Slavs and tributaries. Their position within the Carpathian Basin would come to be accepted by the powers around them because of this, and they would continually make formal treaties with states such as the Byzantines. During the 8th century, the Avars would undergo a period of partial Slavicization and cultural transition. They would perhaps adopt a Slavic language as a lingua franca, while still preserving many steppe customs and their own separate social class. Art and armor would be simpler but more unique, with the mythical griffin becoming a common symbol found in gravesites, along with far less gold and coins than in previous years. Despite this seeming simplification, it is thought that the Avars might have been on their way to construct a more stable society through integration. There is evidence of attempts to install their own minted currency, in opposition to the Mediterranean influence of prior years. They would also begin constructing proper fortifications, showing a distance from reliance on steppe tactics and an acceptance of the Carpathian Basin as their de jure home. Part of this change may have been due to the gradual warming that the climate was undergoing at the time. From the low points of the 400s and 500s, Europe was becoming warmer and wetter, which for Pannonia meant more trees across the plains. This environment promoted the Slavic ways of life over those of the steppe, and may have spurred this cultural trend along with time together. However, the Avar downfall would be that this process was not completed. The Avar class, which had always been a steppe political-cultural union more than an ethnic group, would stubbornly remain separated from their overwhelmingly Slavic populations. This would remain true even as the environments changed and the Confederation settled into its own niche. The nature of this style of union meant that the majority of the population likely had no goodwill towards the subjugators, and this would build up the resentment of the conquered. The Avars, now forced to rely increasingly on their own military forces, would find themselves weakened with the lack of effective grazing grounds in Pannonia due to the increasing forestation. In this vulnerable state, they would face a sudden attack from the Franks to the west. And unlike the Bulgars, it would only take a few devastating defeats to wipe the Avars out for good. But what were those Franks doing so far east? Aren't they a little far from home? It seems events back on the plateau have also been developing quickly. And next week, we will finish our series on the First Dark Age and the long 8th century with a look into the history of the Frankish civilization after Clovis, including those lost kingdoms of Neustria, Aquitaine, Burgundy, and our protagonists on the borderlands of the plateau, Austrasia. But with that, thank you for listening. I'm Jacob, and this has been Between the Seas. So it seems these episodes may spring into the 40s quite often now. Although I can't make any promises on the length, I wouldn't be surprised to see this pretty commonly now as the show finds its rhythm. As a reminder, feel free to let me know any questions or comments you might have about the show by emailing me at betweentheseas@zohomail.com. And I hope that even in those times of crisis, you can find a way to land on your feet.